Welcome to Mango Tiger, the show that focuses on enabling, motivating, and inspiring you to let go of your past, release your emotions, remove. Welcome to Mango Tiger, the show that focuses on enabling, motivating, and inspiring you to let go of your past, release your emotions, remove your hidden blocks to create a great present and a dynamic future. Margaret Stewart was nominated Citizen of Australia for her work with the mind. She conducts workshops around the world and is a keynote speaker at international and national conferences. Margaret has authored and co-authored numerous acclaimed books, including her latest book, Free to Be Healthy, helping people release the blocks and obstacles held in the subconscious mind that were preventing them from being successful and achieving their goals. So here is the host of Mango Tiger, Margaret Stewart.
George A. Burke of Scottsdale, Arizona, is a nationally recognized motivational speaker, author, and trainer with one heck of a story to tell. His awards include the Bronze Star, the Air Force Commendation Medal, Presidential Award for Outstanding Employee with a Disability, Department of Defense Outstanding Employee with a Disability, Department of the Navy Outstanding Employee with a Disability, Air Force Meritorious Civilian Service Award, the Adrian College Michigan Alumni Achievement Award, and in 1998, George was inducted into the Adrian College Athletic Hall of Fame. Hello, George. Welcome to the Mango Tiger Show.
Good day, mate. Good day, Margaret. Nice to have you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You have such an amazing story to tell. I know my listeners were going to be absolutely and utterly fascinated. So what I'd like to do is to allow your absolutely fascinating story to unfold as we chat. Is that okay with you?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. I'm really interested to know what influences your thinking. So let's start with how you came to be in the Air Force and how your school and home experience led you into that field. So just tell us a bit of your background there.
Okay. I had always, growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'd always had a dream since I was about 9 years old to sign a major league to sign a professional baseball contract and hopefully one day play in the American major leagues.
Oh, wow.
I played high school, college, Legion ball. In the last summers I was in college, I worked in Adrian, Michigan, for a man on a semi-pro team and sponsored a team. And I was, from the time I was about 16, I was fairly heavily scouted. I was left-handed, I pitched.
A Molly Duker. Molly Duker is a left-hander.
Oh.
In Australia.
Left-hander.
Yeah.
late the summer, between my junior and senior in college, I was in a playoff environment in a town called Toledo, Ohio, and something happened. It wasn't anything with my motion. But I got caught out in a rainstorm, and instead of me running to the press box, I walked. I always carried two sweatshirts with me. I changed sweatshirts, put the uniform blouse back on, my blue pitching nylon pitching jacket, and didn't think anything of it. The game was rained out. The next morning, I woke up and I could not raise my arm any higher than parallel with my shoulder. It never really responded. I played ball in my senior year. My arm really never came back. I graduated. Had a bounced around in a couple of jobs after I graduated. I had a brother-in-law who was in the Air Force at the time. He was a pilot. And family members had served in World War II and in Korea. And being in the military was always, I guess, part of in the back of my mind. It was was something that, in the way I was raised in our community, that it was a privilege and a responsibility that you had to serve your country in some capacity.
Right.
So, fast forward some details. I went down in the summer of 63 at the Lenawee Hotel in Adrian, Michigan, a town of about 20,000 people, and took my physicals for the Marine Corps and the Air Force. I came very close to going to Marine Corps Officers Candidate School, but didn't get on the bus to go to Quantico, Virginia. I went back to Adrian. A couple of weeks later, I get a call from the Air Force recruiter. I come down for my physical. I went down for my physical. And about a month later, I drove down to... I'd been married. I just got married. Mm-hmm. My wife and I drove down from Adrian, Michigan to Lackland Air Force Base, and I was entered into Officer's Candidate School at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, San Antonio, Texas. And I graduated commissioned as second lieutenant May of 1964.
Really? Yeah. So what did you know about yourself as a person? You know, like it's quite an interesting background there, but what gifts or strengths did you recognize in yourself?
The strength to compete.
Yep.
My athleticism, my will, my drive to be successful.
Yeah.
My love of, my family played a large role, especially my mom, my mother.
As mothers do.
My current wife, Olga, my mother was always my best friend. In fact, that's the title of my third book, My Mother, My Friend, The Story of a Boy and the Love of His Mother.
Yeah.
She was always supportive of me and my sister. And I guess, to boil it down, I never wanted to do anything that would disappoint her.
Yeah.
She had goals for me long before, probably when I was in grade school, is when the first time I heard about United States Military Academy at West Point, or the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis. Because she always wanted me, her only son, to go to one of those two institutions.
Oh,
so
really?
Early on in my life, my mother especially always had high expectations and dreams for me.
Mm.
And I think over time I absorbed them because I wanted to be successful in my life. I was highly competitive. I was physically fit. And I was always involved in athletics in some capacity.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, growing up in a home like that, you know, you can see your mum's influence coming through, but you must have had within yourself as well some very strong guiding principles.
I did. I realize them even more now that the age that I am. I realize that it's trying to be as competent as possible, personally and professionally as competent, taking a great deal of pride in myself. It's not external to internal, it's internal to external. Everything about life is about a choice.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Who we are, what we say, how we dress, how we act. A man that gave me the job in the summer in Adrian always used to say, a man is known by the words he uses and the company he keeps, so choose them both wisely.
Yeah.
And I think that people see you before they hear you, and that's one of the messages that I share with the cadets at West Point and the midshipmen at the Naval Academy is your character is all that you really have, and your integrity. So my mother pounded into me as a young boy that a man is naked without integrity, and I said, well, doesn't he get cold in the winter? And she said, no, honey, I'm not talking about clothing for his body. I'm talking about clothing for his soul.
Soul, yeah, absolutely. Fantastic principles there, isn't it? You know, and a good message for an awful lot of people that is the essence of a man, isn't it, really?
Well, a man or a woman, there's no.
Well, I was using man as a general, in a general
term.
Yeah,
I understand. There's no quick fix.
No.
It's like the old cliche, life is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Mm.
My hospitalization and those of the fellows that I was in the hospital with, it was a second by second, minute by minute, day by day, hour by hour. Time stopped. I think the psychologists call it a provisional existence, where time literally seemed to stop.
Yeah.
And you reach down into the depths of your soul to a place that I never knew existed, and you find out really who you are as a person.
Mm.
How bad do you want something? That's one of the things my mother always tried to inculcate in me, is always try your best. If you want something bad enough, go get it, work hard, but always know that I will love you.
Mm.
And don't ever quit and don't ever give up. No matter what the situation is, always pursue your dreams and your goals.
And you'll always get there.
Yes. And I think that I think that that's the key to being successful. Is, you know, there's an ad here that you have some of these athletic commentators in the States. They have a commercial for Dove men's soap.
Right.
Dove men's products.
Mm-hmm.
It's bars and creams.
Yep.
And some of the well-known commentators come on. They say, "Well, I didn't get this interview, and I got that interview, and yes, I struggled. My name is so and so, and I am definitely comfortable in my own skin." And it's an advertisement for Dove men's
products,
soaps.
Yeah, we've got them here in Australia.
Well, that's one of the things that I had to relearn literally from the ground up, is how to be comfortable in my new skin.
Yes. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. I want to get the early background to it, and then we'll get on more to that, because it's just such an incredible story. And you know, I mean, we can use the cliches like brave and incredibly brave and strong and all that, but I just want to build to that story in a moment, and so that people really understand what it was that was within you that enabled you to survive something that you know, 14 people or other people didn't do. Did you think when you joined the Air Force that you were fully prepared for what, I mean, you were a great athlete, you had some very, very good guiding principles. I was looking, did you really think you were fully prepared for what you're about to undertake, or is it like most things that we think we know what we're stepping into, but we have absolutely no idea until we start? How did you...
I think the latter part, Margaret, is more to the point. I think that's spot on. Given my circumstance, and we'll get into, as you mentioned, we'll get into it in a few minutes. Now, there was nothing that I could have ever done in my life that could prepare me for the challenge, and that's just a word that I was facing.
Yeah.
I could not do it again because I know what the situations were. I know the physiological and the psychological stressors, having to relearn everything all over again. But I think that when I experienced death for the first time, and I knew I was dying, and I knew I was going through this transition time, everybody has a soul.
Yeah.
I call it the second self. My second self saw me and put me places that were totally bizarre. My mind, my soul was taking me away. But I wanted to live.
Mm.
I didn't want to die.
Mm. And that's
I wanted to see my mother. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to see my wife. I wanted to see my children again. And I think that it's more of what I probably didn't accomplish in my life than I did. Because I knew the mistakes that I'd made. I knew what I had done properly and right. But I think that we learn more from adversity and our mistakes than we do when we do something correct.
We certainly
have something to build upon.
Yeah, I think we certainly learn that we actually are very, very resilient people. Let me then just fill our listeners in, because I think we've given them some hints as to what happened, and I'd just like to tell the story a little bit, and you can fill it out in just a sec, of what actually happened. So in May 1970, you're in the Air Force, and you're the sole survivor of 14 passengers in a military plane crash. Your crew was en route to Spokane, Washington, to conduct an operational analysis. Ascending through 3,000 feet, the aircraft experienced rapid decompression and massive structural failure, crashing in the hills near Shellville, California. I think I pronounced that right. It's an Australian pronunciation if it's not.
You're doing very well.
Thank you. I mean, we don't think we've got an accent, but I mean, hey, we might have.
I love the Aussie's accent.
Thank you. As a result of this accident, you suffered severe burns and multiple internal injuries. George, you spent 90 days in intensive care, where you had two near-death experiences and spent 18 months in the hospital. Then you were medically retired from the Air Force in 1971. Having a look at that accident, did they ever know what caused the crash?
At first, no one knew. I never found out about it, and probably until maybe 3 or 4 years after that fact. when some general officers and a couple of Air Force colonels literally stood behind me and my family and enabled me to transition back into society, if you will.
Yeah.
At first, they thought it was a bird strike, pilot error, cause unknown. But I do know on several events coming back on that same airplane from the upper Midwest, like North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, coming back to Hamilton, which was basically 40 miles northeast of San Francisco across the Golden Gate Bridge, mm-hmm. in a place called Marin County, California, that several times on flights returning to Hamilton, we would have to declare an en route emergency. Our pilot, the crew, would have to descend below 10,000 feet where oxygen, internal oxygen is not required. Essentially, what happened was the airplane had been written up. There was a problem with the pressure system on the airplane. The airplane was never fixed properly. Mm-hmm. And essentially that morning, the May 4th, we took off. And I remember everything that happened, all the processes that were involved with the decompression and the structure failure and the ride down. I remember the impact and the crash.
Gosh.
So what happened was the airplane was never, I think that the Navy, they called it gun decking, mm-hmm. where they check off something as being done properly, where in fact it was not inspected properly. And they even think that the airplane had been shined, the outside skin of the airplane had been buffed and shined so much for inspections, if you will.
Yeah.
That the rivets that attached the skin of the airplane to the mainframe, the spars, had been compromised somehow.
Oh, dreadful. Yeah. Did it leave you feeling bitter?
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Bitter's a nice term.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you lost 13 mates.
Pejoratives.
Mm.
But the bitter, angry, frustrated, on levels that I had never experienced. I mean, I've been angry before, frustrated before, mm. but never to the emotional depths that I experienced, not just about what had happened, how it happened, where it happened, when it happened, but that, why was I the only survivor? Why was everybody else killed? Mm. Why me?
Mm.
And I tried to save some of the guys from the inside of the airplane, and I couldn't get to it because I got blown back by a secondary explosion.
Yeah.
So all these guilt feelings. There was no such thing as PTSD or survivor guilt.
Mm. Mm.
Guys in Vietnam, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and back in the 70s, ever fighting Agent Orange was all in your head.
Oh, yes. I mean, we can speak again on that. I mean, that was an amazing denial of Agent Orange and the effects of it. And, of course, a lot of the Vietnam vets are now experiencing long-term effects from that. But we'll come back to that at another time. I mean, you've just had such an incredible life. How did you escape from that? You know, I mean, you've got 14 of you there. I'm assuming the others were killed outright. And how did you actually escape from that plane?
Although I do not consciously remember doing so, Margaret, I told those around me, my doctor, the nurses, the mother of my three children, my mom. I had been vaccinated with a Victrola needle for the first 10 days because I was nonstop babbling.
Yes.
I dug my way through a crack in the fuselage of the aircraft.
Oh, right.
I do not consciously remember doing that.
Mm.
I remember the windows cracking, sending a senior NCO in the front compartment, seated in the front compartment of the airplane with me. Mm. He was across an aisle, two senior NCOs, they were both next to windows. His window cracked about three-fourths of the way up to glazing. I yelled across the table above where on climb out, "You better go forward and tell Pappy." Pappy was our flight engineer, crew chief, he was an Air Force Master Sergeant. But we may have a problem. And Kenny, who was a senior master sergeant in the Air Force and was wearing his blue Air Force raincoat, unbuckled, slid across, and went forward into the cockpit. And all time becomes relevant. hard to define, but I think probably in 10 or 15 seconds, the next thing I heard was a sound similar to only louder, more pronounced, and then it was just a slight pause and then boom. But the boom was unlike any noise that I'd ever heard before. As soon as that boom hit, the airplane decompressed, the windows were blown out, the airplane began to pitch yaw, roll, the noise was deafening. I glanced to my left, I glanced to my right, went out of the windows that were blown open, and we were on the leading edge of the wing, about 3 feet, the cockpit side of the wing. It was a two-engine tricycle landing gear, piston-driven airplane. The props were windmilling in the air. Mm-hmm. Flame was lapping over and under the engine cowlings. I unbuckled my seatbelt. I stood up, and I did a 180-degree turn, and I grabbed the hold of what was the structural bulkhead doorway, and I looked down into the cockpit. Kenny was coming back up the aisle at me. The wind shear was so great that his Blue Air Force raincoat was flapping like a flag from his armpits out. Pappy, our crew chief, had the door handle down, attempting to keep the door, the stairwell, from severing at the fuselage. Mm. Our flight engineer, who was a tech sergeant, was in his flight engineer's position between the pilot and co-pilot, maneuvering the throttles. The instrumentation panel was back in my boss's lap, who was flying his co-pilot. He was an Air Force colonel. The top part was like someone had taken a can opener and peeled it back, and it was flapping. The nose was split open. The left side was completely gone. And although I do not consciously remember Chuck Robinson, Robbie, our pilot, he was decapitated. I sat back down in my seat. I buckled my seatbelt, put something in my lap, a cushion or something that had blown free. I assumed a survival position as best as I possibly could. Mm. And I knew I was dead. The last conscious thought I remember having, because people have asked me this before over the years, was I hope my insurance policies are intact.
Oh,
and then I remember the impact, the shearing and bending and breaking of metal. I was thrown violently back against the back of the structural bulkhead. We had airline-type seats, and then physics, action, reaction. When the airplane stopped moving, my face was thrust violently, my upper torso. My face struck the table in front of us and broke my nose. I instinctively unbuckled my seatbelt. I stood in a standing position 3/4 of the way up. I was in an aisle seat, flying backwards against the bulkhead, and I hollered at Fred Adams, who was next to me, can you still hear me?
Yes, yes, yes.
I've lost the picture.
Oh, that's all right. Don't worry about the picture there. Okay. That's fine.
And, I told Fred Adams, who was sitting next to me, come on, Fred, let's get the hell out of here. Then it was like someone had dumped a large bucket of scalding hot water on me. Next thing I knew, I woke up right outside the airplane, maybe 10 to 15 feet away, face down. Mm. And I rolled over my back. My hands were black like they'd been charcoal. And I thought I heard somebody crying for help inside the airplane. I rolled back on my stomach and elbows and knees clockwise, almost 180 degrees back to the airplane. I heard hissing noise, a muffled explosion, a great deal of heat in my face, and some pejoratives about nobody alive in that such and such airplane.
Yeah.
I better go back where I came from. So I reversed, crawling over what turned out to be parts of airplane and eucalyptus tree.
Yeah.
And I saw our crew chief off to our left. He had a dime-sized puncture wound in his cerebellum.
Yeah.
And one of my good friends, who's an Air Force major, was elevated about a 45-degree angle and maybe 15 yards away from me. And he was black and swelling, and smoke was coming off his body. And I just knew instinctively the will to survive. It's in all of us, the will to survive. If I knew if I sat there, I was going to die, and I didn't want to die, and I started to exhort myself and curse at myself, get on your feet, get on your feet, keep your body functions moving.
Yeah.
And I stood up, I felt a terrible pain in the lower part of my back, and I thought, my God, my back's broken. Then I said, well, you dumb SOB, if your back was broken, you won't be able to walk.
Yeah.
What was? And I walked on an old cow trail for about 40 minutes until I started to go into shock, and I laid down in some waist-high prairie grass.
My goodness. What? You were the only survivor, weren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
Did,
I was.
Why do you think you survived and the others didn't? Was it the positioning? I know it's the will to live, and I'm a great believer that you were meant to survive. You know, I'm a great believer we have a soul, and there's, you know, when if it's our time's up, it's up, but if it's not, nothing is going to kill us. What do you think, why do you think you survived that and your mates didn't?
You know, Margaret, that's something 41 years after the crash I still deal with, I still fight with, frankly. Yes, where I was seated on the airplane had some bearing on it because, as best it can be determined, the airplane hit, it telescoped about three-fourths of the way back. We had 1,500 gallons of aviation fuel. It did almost a 180-degree turn, and the left wing was severed at the fuselage, and it spewed aviation fuel all over the back of the epnage, at the back of the aircraft, trapping most of the guys in the airplane. Oh. Yes, where I was seated had something to do with it, but I think just the basic, that coupled with the basic instinct, my physical strength, my mental strength, my desire to get the hell out of that airplane, that I was not going to sit there and let events dictate my life. I mean, I like this. It's not exactly, you know, I didn't think about it. You just react.
Yes.
You just react. You don't, there's times in your life that you just react, and you hope that you make the right choice, the right decision. And all those decisions that you make are based upon everything you've done right and wrong in your life, your relationships, and everything that's weaved into your life to that very second. I just didn't want to die. I was not going to sit there. It was instinct. It was my military training. It was my athleticism. It was my physical strength, my emotional strength, and my desire to live.
Yeah. Obviously, you had that strength in you. Prior to, I mean, you were a fit guy. You were mentally and emotionally fit guy, and those are the things that stood you in good stead. It is a real statement that we should be making ourselves mentally, emotionally, and physically as fit as we can day to day. Not because there might be a trauma that, such as you've experienced, but just so that we give ourselves the best capacity to survive any trauma that may happen to us. Did you ever now or then experience survivor guilt?
Yes, ma'am, I still do.
You still do?
I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, they didn't have a name for it back then. Now they recognize it.
Yeah, they did. I remember asking in my first book, I mentioned sitting and talking to my primary care physician, my burnologist, Dr. Welford Debienz. He's retired, lives in Dover, Delaware now. One of the many times that he took time to talk to me when he had other patients. And I recall when I asked him, Doc, what happens to the guys when they leave here? He looked at me and said, George, we don't know. We heal the body. We don't have time to heal the mind.
Oh, my goodness.
Fortunately now, for veterans, there are programs, but the veteran has got to be willing to acknowledge, much like an alcoholic or drug addict, that you have a problem. Because if you don't acknowledge it, the problem is going to reside in yourself. It's all about you making the decision to acknowledge you have a problem. That's the first step. But when there's no programs, I didn't know what I was feeling. I didn't know what I was dealing with. Temper, I get anxious, I get angry when I ache, I get angry when I itch, then I feel guilty that I'm alive. I'm not supposed to be angry because I ache. I'm not supposed to be angry when I itch. And it was like a gerbil on a flywheel. And I didn't know why. I had nobody to talk to. No one understood us. I mean, I couldn't talk to anybody about how I felt because, and they say, yeah, I understand what you feel. I say, no, you don't.
No, nobody would.
You don't have an idea. You don't have no idea what I feel and what I'm feeling and why I feel like I feel. So I didn't have it. Part of the solution, I think the step is defining it, giving it a name. That helps.
Yes.
But then you've got to do something with it.
Yeah. You see, I specialize in the subconscious mind, and you know, your subconscious is the one that wanted you to survive, but that's probably also some part of your subconscious is still reliving some of that trauma. But yeah, I don't think there's anybody who could understand exactly what you went through. I mean, most people would hate to go through the crash, let alone go through what you had to do to survive, and how to actually come to terms with being burnt. George, what I'd like to do is just take a quick break at the moment, and then I'll come back to you in a little while, and then I'd like to explore that idea a little bit further with you if you're willing. So we'll just take a break now.
Absolutely.
Thank
you.
You are listening to Margaret Stewart's Mango Tiger Radio Show. Be sure to check out her latest book, Free to Be Healthy, where you will be given techniques, exercises, and case studies that will give you insight on how to change your life for the better forever. Because you too are free to be healthy. Now we return to Margaret Stewart.
So I'm speaking with George Burke, and George has the most amazing, incredible story of trauma and survival. He is the sole survivor of a plane crash, 14 people, and we're just talking about that with George now. So George, welcome back. What was it like? I mean, it's a terrible question to ask you, I suppose, but what was it like being physiologically and psychologically being severely burned? I mean, most of us would feel completely traumatized by that, and obviously you were. You didn't have, as we've just been saying, they didn't recognize post-traumatic stress. They didn't have any way of dealing with it. It's like, we'll patch you up physically, but you know, we don't know what to do with you psychologically. I mean, thank God we're starting to realize that people have these traumas, and we're starting to learn how to deal with post-traumatic stress. But let's go back. What was it like being, I don't mean the physical pain, I can imagine that, but what did you experience psychologically through being burned? What did you feel?
The actual sensation was like I was being stung by bees or mosquitoes continuously.
Hmm.
I was insane with thirst. I had no spit. I couldn't breathe. Didn't recognize anyone. I had a ventilator that breathed for me for 3 months. And a lot of other medical issues, any one of which were supposed to lead to my demise.
Yeah. Sounds like you were stubborn. I'm not going to let this get me.
I think I inherited that from my mother.
Yeah.
She was extremely stubborn.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't take no for an answer, and she didn't quit on anything she ever tried in her life, whether she was successful or not, but she always tried. And I think, as I said earlier, I believe I inherited that from her.
Yeah.
But I think that what I thought was, at first, was complete and utter doubt. Maybe that's not a good word. Frustration, disbelief.
Yeah, I was going to say disbelief.
I believed for many weeks, even when I was so sick and literally dying in the ICU, that my subconscious mind that you referred to, I call it my spirit or my second self. I saw myself dying.
Mm.
I knew I was dying.
Mm.
My mind took me to our home in Pittsburgh, to the living room. I was on the floor at our living room in Hamilton, in the housing, base housing. And I was asking, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I in bed here at home? Why is my mother wearing that mask? Why is she here? I knew what was going on around me. They were there. Mm. But my mind was taking me away to try to alleviate as much of the discomfort and the distress that my body was experiencing,
yeah,
and my mind, my spirit, my second self was experiencing, that I knew that I was going through something that was totally alien. In my worst nightmare, and in fact, I thought I was hungover, really sick, some SOB was playing one nasty trick on me. And any minute now, I was going to wake up, and whoever was playing the trick on me and was going to say, ha ha, we got you this time, we got you a good one, this one.
Mm.
But I never woke up. It wasn't a dream.
No. The mind has a wonderful capacity to protect us from deep trauma. You know, it's interesting when you were going through the plane crash and through the medical treatment, your mind has stepped out of body and sort of tried, as you said, tried to alleviate the pain and get you focused on other things. I find the mind the most fascinating part, you know, to actually work with and to listen to and to understand or try to understand. It's a wonderful, wonderful capacity for protecting us. How did people respond to you, both in hospital but also initially when you were released from hospital? Because you said you had a new skin and obviously you had deep burns and traumatic burns. Were the burns to most of your body? I mean, you know, you look quite a handsome man there, so I'm assuming your face wasn't burnt.
It was burned. All my hair was burned off.
Right.
Tips of my ears are gone. I'm not as nearly as red, and as the burns, the scars aren't nearly as visible as they once were because they're smooth, because of diet, because of exercise.
Yeah.
And a lot of reasons, but.
Well, you look pretty damn good from here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think that what I was feeling was scared.
Yeah.
When I was in the hospital, there were guys that there were patients, younger kids. I was 20. I spent my 29th birthday in the ICU. A lot of the kids that I was in the hospital with were kids. I mean, they were 18 to 22. Much like in today's. Unfortunately, today's society and our military, both Australian and American military, they're 18 to 22, 23 years old. They had a double whammy. They were not only burned, but they were burned in Vietnam.
Yes.
There were kids that went home and come back to the hospital early, you know, relative, a mother, a father. Back then, you were either pro-military or...
Yep.
You got what you deserve, baby killer.
Yeah.
And they come back... And we looked at the burn unit as a womb.
Mm.
WOMB,
yeah.
Our security blanket.
Yeah.
There was always somebody worse than we were.
Yeah.
The nurses and the doctors didn't really gawk at you. I remember the first time I got into a van, and I went down to the post exchange at Fort Sam Houston, where the burn unit was located, and I was shuffling through in my blue pajamas with both my legs wrapped in gauze. This is before Job stockings.
Yeah.
And this little kid ran up to me in one of the aisles. He was with his mother, and he looked up at me and said, "Mommy, mommy, mommy, look at him, look at him." And I remember thinking to myself, "You little so." If I could have raised my arm or raised my leg to hit the kid, I would have.
Yeah.
So it was a matter of being. We are an external society. We base our relationships in part by what we see.
Yes.
And when you see yourself one way, and then you see yourself in the mirror, a totally different way.
Yeah. How did you handle that?
Move an arm, move a leg, do something. Who is that ugly so-and-so looking back at you in the mirror? That certainly isn't me.
Yeah.
Well, it was me.
Yeah.
And it's a real shock to the psyche. It's a real shock to the male ego.
Yep, yep. I mean, we all experience it as we get older. We look in the mirror and we see an older version of... Because internally we're still 30, 40, 50, whatever. But we see this older face in the mirror and go, that's not me. I haven't got those wrinkles. I haven't got that grey hair. I'm actually really a young person. But you look in the mirror and it tells you otherwise. That must have been really hard for you to reconcile the two, the image of the new you with the image of... who you were some, you know, 90 days before, let's say. I mean, that's a complete change of image of self acceptance. And you're quite right. We are a very, very visual society, and we accept people who look what we would call good. If they look good to us, we accept them. We're a lot more friendly to them. We're a lot more accepting of them. We're a lot more responsive to them. And that must have been really, really tough. Really tough.
It was very difficult. I mean, it was it was not just the way I looked. I mean, I was, there was guys that I felt you feel sorry for yourself. They didn't see someone without a face, literally, or no arms or no legs, and you think, wait, stop complaining. You don't have it so bad.
Yeah.
But that coupled with how I looked and what I felt and what I was sensing and what I was going through, coupled with having to completely relearn everything all over again. I mean, I was left-handed. I lost half my left hand. The fingers were all gone. It's got a cleft. I'm not supposed to have any arms or legs. And that's a whole story about my doctor and his competence and not giving up on me. But the way the injuries and the burns, when you stand, you feel like your legs are going to explode. You feel like you're on fire. Your arms are on fire. Then you have to learn how to walk and talk and stand and feed yourself. And you can't eat. You don't want to eat. You literally have to go right brain, left brain, all over again. Left brain, right brain, right brain, left brain. You literally had to learn everything all over again. That's very demeaning.
Yes. Yes, because you're a strong man. You're a strong man mentally, physically, emotionally. You have an image of yourself as capable of all of that, and you go back to being vulnerable.
That's a good point. I was vulnerable, and I knew it. Mm. And for the first time in my life, I was totally, emotionally, physically, physiologically reliant on other people.
Yeah.
To keep me alive.
Yeah.
To wipe my butt, to brush my teeth, to feed me, to get me out of bed, to put me back in bed.
Yeah.
Everything. I was, and that really, that is an extremely demeaning situation, but I always tried, something inside of me always tried to find some humor.
Mm. Yeah, humor is amazing, isn't it?
Humor is healing.
Yes.
That's why the title of my fourth book, The Laugh You Live, Cry You Die.
Yeah.
That was a saying some of these guys had in the war, because there was enough crying and enough dying. You might as well laugh about it because you can't do anything about it. And there's, believe it or not, there were some comical things that happened in hindsight. But humor will get you through just about anything.
Yes, it will, won't it? Won't it? Yeah, yeah. I just know from my own life, whenever things have been fairly traumatic, I've had that capacity for humour, which is great. So I really understand what you're saying there, and I think that is it's human nature too. Certainly for Aussies, and I'm assuming for other people around the world too. But if something is going very wrong in Australia, you'll find all our sense of humour comes out quite dramatically. It is amazing. But I don't want to interrupt your story. It's just quite an amazing thing. And, of course, what's coming through all the time is that will to live, that will to live. When you had those two, I believe you had two near-death experiences, I would say it was one continuing for the whole 90 days. Tell me a bit about those death experiences or near-death experiences. What were they like?
I was in my uniform.
Yep.
The day the plane went down, my summer weights, it's 15, what they call 1505s.
Yep.
All of a sudden, I'm on a deck of a boat. I'm getting sick, and I'm getting cold, sicker and colder. Colonel Shelton was in his orange flying suit. He was my boss, co-pilot of the aircraft. We come through these swinging double doors, and I remember the panes of the windows, and there's this oval-shaped bar, and there are three to four deep people in this bar. It's an excursion boat. And he says, "Come on, George, I'll buy you a drink." "I don't want to drink, Colonel. I'm too sick. I'm going to go sit down." Suddenly, I find myself in the middle of two couples, a red vinyl soda fountain booth, with a aluminum strip around the table, a single leg, blue-green top. I don't know how I got there, but I'm getting sicker and I'm getting colder. I look to my left. I look to my right. I can't hear anything. Mouths are moving. 15 or 30 minutes later, I don't know why that number is relevant, but 15 or 30 minutes later, Colonel Shelton comes over a second time and says, "Come on, George, it's time to go." Well, Colonel Shelton's dead. He died in the crash.
Right.
I said, "I'm not going with you. I'm too young to die." He reaches across the table, pulls me up over the table. We lock arms. His left arm and my right arm. We walk out through one of the several double sets of doors with three little window panes on each side. Step out on the deck, teakwood deck, railing, water that's blue-green, calm as the top of a table. Off to the right, I see a wooden enclosed bridge. About every 3 feet, there is a window.
Mm-hmm.
We start to make our way towards the bridge, where the gangplank or bridge where it meets the boat. There's people walking past us. I'm starting to shuffle my feet. I'm getting sicker and colder. We get to where the boat meets the bridge. I have to break free of his grasp, and I reach down behind each knee, and I grunt, and I use the last bit of my strength to pull my legs up and place them 2 or 3 inches onto the bridge. We lock arms again. We're walking across this bridge, and it's slightly bowed. I remember thinking, I'm halfway to where I'm going. I've got to use the last bit of my strength to break free of his grasp. I'm too young to die. I don't want to die yet.
Mm, mm.
I grunted, literally, and I broke free. I turned around. I started going back to the deck of the boat. There was I still remember faces when I think about it.
Yeah.
Young, old, tall, short, heavy, thin, male, female, running across this bridge. I get back down to the deck of the boat. The sickness and the coldness, relatively speaking, began to dissipate somewhat. I turned around. I saw Colonel Shelton disappearing into the brightest light I've ever seen, and I smelled flowers. The second time, I'm laying on my back, and all of a sudden, it's like you look through the reverse end of a set of binoculars through a pin, and I see this brightest light I've ever seen again. There's a loud rushing of wind, and there's the two NCOs that are in the front compartment with me. And I said, Fred, Ken, what the hell are you guys doing here? And Freddie Adams was the master sergeant. You know, he kind of talked out of the side of his mouth. He said, it's okay, Captain Burke, we're all right. You need to get better. And whoosh, they were gone.
Wow.
And unknown to me, that this had happened. I mean, I knew that it happened, but one of the break rooms, my legs propped up, my legs wrapped in gauze and snow cone and patches in me, and I had a tree and catheter in me, etc. I sat and talked to Dr. Inge again, and I went in vivid detail, even more detail than I just explained it to you, about the bridge and Colonel Shelton and the boat.
Yep.
And the flowers and the smell and the light and Kenny and Freddie in the tunnel. And he was looking right at me intently with his knees. He had his scrubs, the mask was around his neck, his bonnet was still on, his rubber gloves were off. He was leaning towards me, his knees, his arms on his knees. Then he leaned back and crossed his arms, looked at the ceiling and sighed. Then he leaned forward again and looked me right in the face. He said, now I know what you're trying to tell us. I said, what the hell are you talking about, Doc? Mm. And he told me the date and time. It had been probably sometime in July. He said, I opened my eyes once, and I used to shake so violently. I used to shake the pigskin and homographs off me.
Yeah.
And I had metal chains that a pin through my stub to drip blood for 3 months.
Yeah.
And I had chains on me that strung me up like I was gutted like a pig. And I had a little loincloth across my genital area. Yeah. With catheter in me, and I had tubes in my chest and a tube in my throat and through my nose and down in my lungs and fed me intravenously, etc. And I opened my eyes and I was shaking and I was screaming, the light, the light, the light.
Oh.
My family and he told me, they were asking me, what light, George, what light? And I kept screaming louder and louder and louder, the light, the light, the light. He had large banks of lights, 2 to 3 of them were very extremely hot. Mm. To try to keep you warm. Because you're bitterly cold and you shake continuously.
Yeah.
And they were moving the lights around my bed thinking the lights were blinding me.
Right, and not knowing. Hmm.
And they moved the lights. It wasn't the lights. They gave me more morphine, sedated me. And 5-6 months later, I'm in a break room explaining this detail to him. And I didn't know that I had no knowledge until that time that I had been screaming the light, the light, the light.
Hmm.
And I asked him, Doc, I said, what does it mean, Doc? What do you think? He said, George, you experience what we call the will to survive.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And I said, what am I supposed to do now with the rest of my life? He said, George, we all have a purpose. It's up to you to find your purpose. If you want to, bad enough, you will.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to take a break there, George. That is amazing. And I want to come back to it. So just a couple of seconds. We'll just take a break.
You are listening to Margaret Stewart's Mango Tiger Radio Show. Have you ever questioned why some people who drink and smoke live long lives, while others who appear to be living a healthy lifestyle die young? Margaret Stewart's latest book, Free to Be Healthy, will give you insight into how to release the thoughts, beliefs, and emotions to heal your mind, your body, and your soul. Now, we return to Margaret Stewart.
George, given you've had those two amazing near-death experiences, and I know there are an awful lot of listeners who have had near-death experiences, did that change your attitude to God? Do you believe in God? Did you believe in God beforehand? Do you think this was more than just your free will? Do you think the doctor was right about it? You have a life purpose. I suppose there's four questions in one there.
Four good questions. I can answer that question, those questions, yes. Over the years, I've spoken to a lot of younger audiences, elementary schools, middle school, high schools, high school students in an auditorium setting or in a class, and that basically boiled down to five questions. Do you still fly in an airplane? Yes, aisle seat bulkhead. What's it like being burned? I try to explain what it was like for me being burned, the constant threat, thirst, insane with thirst, the mosquitoes, the bugs biting me.
Yeah.
Like my body was on fire. When did the pain go away? The physical pain, I had been physically pain-free from my neck up and mid-chest on for 41 years, but the pain inside your head is a killer. It's the pain in your head, it's the pain in your conscience. Yeah. It will drive you to drink, drive you to drugs, and that's the pain you have to address.
You haven't gone down that path, though, George.
I'm sorry?
You didn't go down that path, the drink, the drugs.
Well, I did when I was in the hospital. Morphine was the drug of choice.
All right.
And I got strung out in drugs on morphine, and I stopped doing that because I knew what was happening. I just did cold turkey.
Yeah.
I stopped going to therapy. And then I started back after 2 weeks, and I didn't take the morphine shots. Mm-hmm. Hurt like hell, but again, that was another fork in the road in my life, my road towards a physical and emotional recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me, "Do I believe in God?" And I said, "Absolutely, positively. My God's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And I think that purpose gives there's something as far as the purpose is concerned. It's that vision, that dream, a passion that you have about life and living, that you have a bucket list, if you will.
Yep.
Things that you want to do in your life, and you set about defining what they are, developing a plan, a strategy, and surrounding yourself with people that want you to succeed, not fail. Your cheerleaders, your best friends will tell you what you need to know, not what you want to hear. And you set out about trying to find your purpose and being able to speak to the groups, as many groups as I've been privileged to speak over the years, culminating now in my third visit to West Point in March and my 11th visit in 3 weeks to the Naval Academy.
Yeah.
That's the cherry on the sundae. That helps put everything and everyone that have done so much for me to get me in a position where I am today. That adds the purpose of my life, that gives me something to live for.
Yeah. I can remember a mate of mine had lymphatic cancer years ago, and they were standing around his bed saying he's not going to survive, and he looked, there was a clock in front of his bed, and he looked at it and he said, right, nobody's asked me whether I'm going to survive or not, and I'm damn well going to survive. So he said, right now, I'm going to live till 6 o'clock in the morning. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, he looked at the clock and he said, now I'll live till 6 o'clock tonight. And then 6 o'clock at night, he said, now I'll live till 6 in the morning. And that gave him the determination to get through, and as you say, the focus on the family, the focus on what he wanted to achieve. And so, of course, he pulled through. But of course, there's that, from the Second World War, the research has shown that while people had hope, As soon as they had hope, they were the survivors. When they gave up that hope, you knew that, that they'd be dead within minutes. So I guess there's a couple of things there. There's the, there's not only the belief in what I can achieve, what I can do, that gives you the reinforcement every day, and you're obviously achieving a tremendous amount. But there's also that hope that you can give that inspiration and that that never give up story to people in the military as well as civilians. That essence is never give up, no matter what, never give up. Your will to live is an amazing thing, and I think that's also encouraged by, it looks to me like, your belief in a higher being, you know, in a God, in something that is bigger than you, that is your life purpose, why you're here.
Far, far larger than anything that I could even imagine, and I know that I get a lot. I get all my power from Him, and I'm a Christian.
Yeah.
Consider myself a Christian, but I've seen. I know a lot of it is internal. The will to survive, making that choice about what you put in your body, what you eat, how you act, what you say, choosing your friends, but in a life and death mode, where you are literally one breath away from dying, I've seen young men who had survivable injuries lay in bed and were dead in 10 days to 2 weeks.
Yep.
Because family stopped coming. They berated them. I've seen little children. I've heard stories about young children who were seriously injured or burned, that the one that could have supposed to live died.
Yeah.
Brother died because the mother came in and berated him so much that they gave up and they quit. They had no hope.
Yeah, that's dreadful. I can remember, you know, I had cancer in 2003, and my doctor said to me, I said, well, so what do you think of my chances? And he told me, and he said, I see people who we don't expect to survive at all, and they survive. And I've seen others that should have survived with absolutely no problem whatsoever, and they die within months. And he said, we can't work out what it is. But I personally think it's that will to live, and I think you've demonstrated that extremely strongly today. And also the fact that there's a purpose to your life. You know, you just haven't sat back and said, okay, you know, I was a survivor or I was a victim. I think you're a survivor. I mean, to me, a survivor is somebody who really is still living their life and has a future and is working towards it, whereas a victim says, hey, I was burnt, so I can do nothing. You know, I'm going to sit around on my tail until, you know, the day I go.
I agree. I think, you know, to me, I think it boils down, Margaret, I guess best way to define it for me is a victim wants a hand out.
Yes.
A survivor wants a hand up.
That's right.
When they ask for it. And I never considered myself to be a victim. It's a mental thing. It's a pride. It's a grittiness. It's determination.
Yeah.
I'm not going to quit and give up. No way. No way in hell. I'm not going to quit and give up. I got too much to live for.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt when, you know, as say with cancer, I thought, you know, I've got a hell of a lot of life to live, and this is not going to knock me over, you know. But it's a very interesting thing, isn't it, the mind? But you've had other unusual experiences since then too. Tell me about the class ring.
Oh. I was wearing my college class ring the day the plane went down on my right ring finger.
Yep.
My mom and dad bought it for me for $40 in 1963. I do not know who removed it. I do not know when it was removed, but apparently it must. I think piecing the parts of the puzzle back, they airlifted me back in a helicopter after the rancher accidentally discovered me on fire, which I had no knowledge of. No one did for about almost a year. They took me back to Hamilton on a Coast Guard helicopter and took me down to their version of the ICU. And then they found an airplane at Travis Air Force Base in California, C-141, which was loaded with Crispy Critters, that's what we called ourselves, going from Yokota Air Base in Japan to San Antonio. It was making a fuel stop at Travis, and it did it every alternate Mondays for 5 years. On Monday morning, the last call the base commander made at Hamilton was to Travis, and it just happened to be the airplane on the ground. And they diverted over to Hamilton after they topped off the fuel tanks, gurneyed me down, put me back in Air Force ambulance, down to the flight line, carried me across the tarmac up the back of the airplane. We flew two-thirds of the way across the country from Hamilton Air Force Base to San Antonio, Texas. It was an Air Force flight crew. I don't know where they were from. I suspect they might have been from Charleston Air Force Base, South Carolina, on a rotational basis.
Yeah.
Someone removed my class ring. I never saw it again. I thought about it over the years. Well, in 1998, I received an email from a volunteer at our alumni office at Adrian College. And the direct quotes are in my first book, The Bridge Never Crossed, A Survivor's Search for Meaning. George, the email was, I found a ring in the military a while back, the initials in the Aaron Script GAB in 1963. If you know anybody that has ownership of this ring, have them call me, Charles Carrington, Sacramento, California, and the phone numbers. Well, she sent me the email and said, George, this sounds like good news, let me know. It was a Sunday night in March of 1998. It was at 6 o'clock. I come back to the study where I am now in our home. I called a name, a number in Sacramento, California. A man's voice answered. And I said, Mr. Charles Carrington, please. He said, this is Charles. I said, Mr. Carrington, this is Captain George Burke, sir. I think you have my class ring. He told me, we're on the phone. We subsequently met on two separate occasions after that when I was invited to speak in Sacramento, California. The story is that he was a backseater, a radar operator on an F-4D. He had had two tours in Vietnam, one in Vietnam, one in Takley, Thailand as a navigator on board an AC-47 gunship. He was en route from Holland Air Force Base, New Mexico, to what they called a crested cap NATO exercise in Germany. Sometimes they would fly all the way through over the North Atlantic and refuel X number of times. Sometimes they'd stop in bases in Florida, North Carolina. This particular time he stopped for some crew rest at Charleston Air Force Base, South Carolina. Had never been there before. He went in and the pilot went in and had dinner. Went into the men's room. Now, back then, officers' clubs had three or four sinks, three or four mirrors, soap dishes.
Yep.
He was washing his hands at the men's room at the officers' club at Charleston Air Force Base, South Carolina, in September or October of 1970.
Yeah.
And he looked down in the soap dish and saw this ring.
Oh, you're joking.
He picked it up. He picked it up and looked and said, wow, what a beautiful ring. Put it on his ring finger and it fit.
My God.
The ring went to Germany. The ring went back on his second tour to Thailand. He was rifted out of the Air Force when they were downsizing out of Vietnam. He took it off and put it in a footlocker. He was going through his old military memorabilia and found this ring in 1998. Got on the internet and typed in Adrian College and sent an email to the alumni office. 5 days later, I had my college class ring.
My goodness. I'm astounded. It just seems to me as if there's a message coming from God, from the universe, saying, hey,
yes,
you know, not only are you surviving, but hang on, we're acknowledging your survival. This is amazing, absolutely
yep.
amazing. I'm what we say in Australia, I'm gobsmacked. It's just amazing.
I'm still flabbergasted. I can't run because the skin changed and my knuckles and... But I have it, and I'm going to give it to one of my grandchildren.
Yeah.
And there's been other events like that. I've been blessed to be able to have contact with and meet four surviving family members, their children.
Really?
They range in anywhere from 7 to 15, actually 7 to 17. And I'm going to meet the flight engineer's daughter, who's now 55 years of age, in Sun River Resort in Redmond, Oregon, in 11 days. Her and her husband are driving down from Portland. Her dad was our flight engineer.
Oh, my goodness. One can only imagine just what it will mean to them to meet you. I mean, it will be incredible, George. And just, but what a wonderful thing you're doing in meeting up with them. And your story is just so amazing. George, you've alluded to a couple of your books, but I'd just like to let your listeners know, and I'm assuming your books are available because, you know, all of us would want to read them. You're the author of several books, The Bridge Never Crossed, A Survivor's Search for Meaning, which you've spoken about just in our interview, valued-centered leadership, a survivor's strategy for personal and professional growth. That must be so valuable to people. And I think to women who become mums, you know, none of our children come with a manual. And it's, you know, we learn on the ropes. So I can imagine that my mother, my friend, the story of a boy and the love of his mother, the strength your mother has given you, the courage, the impact she has made on your life, I think is the key that you said to that was your mum said to you, no matter what, you know you're always loved. And I think that's a very strong message. And, I'm definitely going to read that book. I think my kids are pretty good, and I'm very proud of them. But I think sure. It's very hard being a mum for the first time, you know, because as I say, you don't come with a manual. And then you've got also another one you've alluded to a couple of times is Laugh You Live, Cry You Die, A Burn Survivor Triumph Over Tragedy. And I think you're quite right. Laughter is one of the greatest healers that we have ever had. Tell me. Many people who survive major illnesses say they're grateful for their illness. Now, I was never grateful for having cancer. I just thought it was a big learning curve and it really showed me how strong and resilient I was. But, you know, I can't say I was grateful for it. Given that you've become a successful author and drawing on that experience, I hate to use the word, are you glad the crash happened? I mean, it was a horrific, and no, I can't imagine you being glad of it. But do you think there were benefits that you received out of having that accident? And I suppose it's with your life purpose.
Absolutely, Margaret, yes.
Yeah.
I really found out who I am.
All right.
I mean, it's a heck of a way to find out the true self, the true identity,
yeah.
Who you really are. But that's one of the things that I've written about and I leave with some of my audiences is that when you look in the mirror, who are you really?
Yeah.
Where are you going? How are you going to get there? Who's going to be on your team?
Yeah.
It was just something that my wife has mentioned to me. She said, are you glad sometimes you're glad that you went through it? And I said, I couldn't go through it again. But to be really honest, save all the lives that were damaged, lost. Yes, in a lot of respects, I am glad I went through it because it has enabled me to see life around me and appreciate life so much more. Birds, sunrises, sunsets, rain, snow crunching under your feet, the air after it rains, hugs. When you're thirsty, you can drink. When you're hungry, you can eat. When you're tired, you can sleep. Go to the bathroom by yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, all the things I took for granted were taken away.
Yes.
And they were given back to me. And I just gratefully and truly, truly blessed.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you meet the man who rescued you?
Yes, ma'am. I met him in 1974 the first time. He didn't know who I was.
Really? Really?
He managed a 2,000-acre cattle ranch in Shellville, and I think it's at least part of it is still a working ranch. And I was a civilian for the Air Force, and I was scheduled, I was on a trip, a business trip, if you will, to Okinawa, Japan.
Yeah.
And I stopped in California. A civilian that I knew at Hamilton, I stayed with him for 3 or 4 days, and I purposely remained there to try to find this Mangles Ranch, this man named John Davio, who found me on fire. The last day I was there, he almost literally stumbled upon the ranch and the gate. He drove me into the property. To this day, I still remember Lori, their youngest daughter, who was 15 years old at the time, as I was walking towards the side of the ranch house. She ran, had just run in, and I can still remember the sound the screen door made as it slammed. I got probably 15 to 20 feet from the door, and my peripheral vision was substantially improved. And off to my right, on a berm, just above roof, about roof level, was a three-sided, a three-stall, two-sided barn. The first stall was a man leaning into a red pickup truck. And I walked up the side of this berm at a 45-degree angle. The sun began to set in the west. It was behind me. And I cleared my throat. And I said, and I was about 15 to 20 feet away from him. He hadn't seen me, and I cleared my throat. And I said, Mr. Davio. He raised up from the engine area of his truck, put on his wireframe glasses, had a red rag, squinting into the sun, wiping his hands on the red rag. And he said, yes, sir, can I help you? And I said, Mr. Davio, do you know who you are? Do you remember me? He took a couple of steps towards me, and he said, no, sir, I don't. I said, Mr. Davio, the last time you saw me, I was on fire.
Oh.
He paused for maybe 5 seconds, raced over to me, grabbed a hold of me, and started to cry.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I started to cry.
Yeah.
And he said, thank my God, you're alive, you're alive. I never thought I'd see you alive. And he started hollering for his wife, Pearl, 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 it's Captain Burke, it's Captain Burke. Then Pearl, Mrs. Davio, and their daughter, Lori, come running out of the side of the house, through the screen door, up the side of the berm. There's four people standing in this berm, jumping up and down, laughing and crying, saying, you're alive, you're alive, you're alive. And I spent 2 days with him. He took me back up into the crash scene. It took us 40 minutes in his four-wheel drive pickup truck. And I walked around the area where he found me and saw the damage from the trees, from the fire, and said a few prayers and went down. And my story was on the Discovery Health Channel. I still have a video of that, and I use it as part of my introduction to my speaking engagements.
Yeah.
He had a fifth of Jim Beam whiskey.
Yes.
And as he says in the video, we did some damage on that. We did some serious damage to that Jim Beam. I saw him about 12 or 13 times after that. My wife Olga had the opportunity to see him. But Mr. Davio passed away 28 December of 2005, a week before his 90th birthday, and Mom Davio passed away. She had Alzheimer's in July of 2006.
Right.
But yes, I did get to see them both, and I corresponded with them often. And every year, for every Christmas for 38 of the 41 years, about 35 years until it's passed, and I still do with Dr. Inge, my other doctor, Dr. Tom Newsom.
Yeah.
I send them a Christmas gift from a Swiss Colony cheesy. Yeah. I send them baklava every Christmas.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. George, we'll just take a break for just 1 minute, and I'll be right back.
Okay.
You are listening to Margaret Stewart's Mango Tiger Radio Show. Margaret's latest book, Free to Be Healthy, is your toolbox to enable you to bridge the gap to a truly healthy life. Take the next step to fulfilling your goals and changing your life forever with Free to Be Healthy. Now we return to Margaret Stewart. Welcome back to Mango Tiger, and I'm speaking to George Burke. Now, George, since then you've become a guest speaker at the United States Naval Academy on issues of character development, ethics, and leadership. You're the guest speaker at the United States Military Academy at West Point, which we've spoken about earlier, on the professional military ethic and character development. Apart from that, you're the guest speaker at Phoenix, Arizona, Glendale and Glendale, Arizona Fire Academies, private, non-profit and professional organizations on issues of leadership, core values, adversity, safety, health and wellness and life skills. You'd be an amazing person to have as a guest speaker, I can tell you now. You've appeared as a guest on a number of radio stations, including mine, but around America, on Canada, on several news and TV stations in Phoenix, Arizona. And in 2001, your story was profiled on the Discovery Health Channel, Life Force Overcoming Obstacles. George, in the last couple of minutes that we've got, where would you like to head personally and professionally, say, over the next 2 to 3 years?
I would like to continue to speak whenever and wherever, given the good Lord sees fit for me to be invited.
Yes.
I don't believe I have any more books in me.
Never say never, George. Never say never.
I'm sorry?
Never say never.
That's true. thanks, Mom.
I told you I was a mum. I did warn you.
I don't have any plans for another book.
That's better.
I will continue to write articles for four newsletters.
Yeah.
There's pretty much safety, quality, and health related.
Yeah.
My wife and I will hopefully continue to be able to travel. I've been to Scotland 3 times. We love it. My bucket list, frankly, is to be able to make it back to Australia one more time before I walk across that bridge the second time.
Yeah, definitely. You've got to come.
And be able to stay healthy, and I eat right, I exercise.
Yeah.
And just to live a good life and to be a good husband. Mm-hmm. And a good human being, and someone that I think my wife and my family would be proud of.
I would say, George, there's absolutely no doubt that anyone, not only your family, but anyone who meets you or has met you would be incredibly proud of you. And I just feel it's been such an absolute privilege to have you on my show and on my radio show. I just feel very honoured that you agreed to come on this show with me. I want to ask you one last question before we round this up. If you could describe one thing that would help someone dealing with trauma at the moment, what advice would you give them?
Don't lose hope. Don't give up on yourself. Yeah. Fight through it. Find the thread. Find a thread in your spiritual psyche, that inner self, that conscience, that voice that you hear. Talk to yourself. Tell yourself not to quit, not to give up. And don't ever lose hope in yourself and in your life. That's the important thing. Yeah. Don't ever, like you mentioned so well before, without hope we have nothing. So don't lose hope. And continue to fight. Find a reason for you to have more purpose in your life, because when you come out of what you're experiencing, you may not be able to realize it right now because of the circumstances, but when you overcome with the adversity that you're being challenged with right now, it is a learning tool, and you're learning an awful lot about yourself as a person, as a human being. And when you complete that part of that journey, you're going to come out of that tunnel a much better human being than you are when you went into it.
Thank you, George. You're so right. Thank you so much for being a guest on my Mango Tiger show. Your story has been incredible. As I said, I am very, very deeply honoured that you have come on my show with me, and I appreciate that, and I thank you very much. If people have any questions, where would you like them to contact you?
They can go to my website. It's www.georgeburk.com. As I tell many of my audiences, there's no E at the end of Burke, and a good way to remember my last name is a form of iambic pentameter. I'll give you an example. If you want to shirk work, call Burke. But if you're looking for a turkey, you need to call a Burkey. So it's www.georgeburk.com. And there's my books, and there's a note there that you can contact me, send me an email, etc. I'd love to hear from the folks.
Fabulous. And your email is...
And maybe one day, if it's in God's plan, I will get a chance to come back and continue to fill my bucket list with a visit to Australia, because I love the Australians. It's a wonderful, beautiful country. I served with a number of mates in Vietnam, and they were good blokes. And
yes.
I just love the country, and I love the people.
Oh, look, that would be amazing. If you can come out here, fantastic. We Aussies will look after you, George, no doubt about that. But you might find you get your elbow bent a bit, and you might put some severe damage to, Jim Beam and, what was it? It wasn't Jim Beam, whatever that drink was, bourbon.
It was Jim Beam.
Yeah, Jim Beam.
I've got one good functional hand, Margaret. I can bend them with the best.
You're on. George, thank you again, and I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Let's stay in touch.
That would be lovely. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
Good day, mate.
Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to Margaret Stewart's Mango Tiger radio show. Every week, Margaret is interviewing ordinary people doing extraordinary things. If you'd like to be a guest on the show,